Millions of Americans are struggling to pay off debts, and debt collectors have found a modern way to employ a very old tactic. Debtors' prisons were abolished in this country well over a century ago, yet some of today's debtors are shocked to find themselves in jail. Susie Ahn reports from member station WBEZ in Chicago.
Imagine you're driving home and an officer pulls you over for having a loud muffler. But instead of sending you off with a warning, you're arrested and taken right to jail. That's what happened to Robin Sanders in Illinois.
That's when I found out I had a warrant for failure to appear in Macoupin County, and didn't know what it was about.
Sanders owed $730 on a medical bill. She says she didn't even know a collection agency filed a lawsuit against her.
They say they send out these court notices, and nobody gets them.
Sanders spent 4 days in jail waiting for her father to raise $500 for her bail. That money was then turned over to the collection agency. Robin Sanders' story is an increasingly common one across the country, in Indiana, Tennessee, and Washington. Here's how it happens. A company will often sell off its debt to a collection agency, often called a creditor. That creditor files a lawsuit against the debtor, requiring a court appearance. A notice is supposed to be given to the debtor, and if they fail to appear in court, a warrant is issued for their arrest. Beverly Yang is a legal aid attorney with Land of Lincoln Legal Assistance. Yang says most debtors don't know their rights. In fact, she says some judges don't even know the debtor's rights. That could result in the debtor being intimidated into a pay agreement.
And I've seen this even when I'm standing in the courtroom as the legal aid attorney. The judge will ask if they can pay, how about $150 a month? How about $75 a month? How come you can't even pay $50 a month? Did you apply for a job last week?
The Federal Trade Commission received more than 140,000 complaints related to debt collection in 2010. That's nearly 25,000 more than the previous year. Yang says some creditors are eager to use harsh tactics.
Whatever the creditors or the creditors' attorneys can do to leverage some kind of payment, it will help their profits enormously because they have literally millions of these.
There's an assumption in what you're saying is that we would rather throw them in jail than work with them. And I don't find that to be true at all.
That's Kevin Kelly, president of the Illinois Creditors Bar Association. He says members of his organization only issue warrants in extreme situations. Kelly says sometimes it's the debtor who's keeping information from the collectors. That prevents important documents from getting to the right place. He says most collectors want to make reasonable arrangements, but it's difficult when the vast majority don't even respond to any notices sent to them. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan thinks more can be done. It's illegal in Illinois for people to be sent to jail because they're in debt. But Madigan thinks some creditors are abusing the law.
You wouldn't be in that predicament if you didn't have debt. I mean, you know, but for being in debt, you wouldn't be in prison. And that essentially equates to being thrown in jail, you know, debtor's prison.
Madigan says courts need to be certain they have correct information to serve notices. She also says judges need to be properly educated in these proceedings to prevent a debtor from needlessly going to jail. Madigan says the state is also investigating agencies that it thinks are abusing the law. As for Sanders, she has a remaining balance of about $160 on her medical bill. But at least she now knows she won't have to go to jail for it. For NPR News, I'm Susie Yon in Chicago.
Seven years after Hurricane Katrina, the city of New Orleans is still smaller than it used to be. Over 140,000 people, the vast majority African American, no longer live there. In their place are new faces, those of the thousands of Latino immigrants who came to help in the city's reconstruction and have now chosen to stay. As part of our series on hard times in America, NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports on this emerging community.
It's a familiar sight in many communities. About a dozen Latino men are hanging out near a home improvement store looking for work in a mostly black neighborhood. 38-year-old Yohani Castillo, a carpenter from Honduras, says he's been here since the early days of Katrina. Carpentry, demolitions, any kind of construction. But lately, he says, there's been less work available. Castillo says the main problem is that employers want workers who have the papers to prove they're here legally. Right after Katrina, no one really cared. The other problem, he says, sometimes he doesn't get paid the wages he's been promised. And everybody here can tell you the same story, says Castillo, because it's happened to everyone. Since Katrina, the Hispanic population in the New Orleans metro area has skyrocketed by more than 33,000 people. That's a 57% increase in the past decade, much higher than the national average. Demographer Allison Plyer says the Hispanic influx since Katrina should surprise no one.
There's actually a phenomenon the demographers call hurricane chasers, where whenever there's a hurricane, whether it's in Florida or along the Gulf Coast, Latinos will go because they know that there will be debris removal work and home repair work. And then they assume that they'll just stay a little while and then they'll go somewhere else. But here, that work lasted for several years, and so folks just stayed.
And it's common to hear the immigrants say they know they played a major role in rebuilding the city when no one else would do the dirty work. After Katrina, a new advocacy group was formed called Puentes, Spanish for bridges, and Jordan Shannon is its spokeswoman.
The city really owes a debt that it is not always so quick to acknowledge, but it nevertheless has really been rebuilt on the back of Latino labor.
Of course, not everyone agrees. On Canal Street, people board streetcars to get home from their downtown jobs. That's where I met David Stroder, African-American, dishwasher, unemployed. He says there's no denying there's some resentment in the black community here towards Latinos.
They don't like the fact that they're coming in and taking all the jobs. It's like me, I'm trying to find a job. But I don't build houses, though. I can't do that. If I could do that, I'd be making some money.
But the work can bring some Latino immigrants closer to the attention of immigration authorities. Just last August, about 30 workers were gathered in the parking lot of an apartment complex in nearby Kenner. They had just wrapped up a job raising the elevation of several homes.
Many workers have lost their lives as they lift up these homes.
That's Jacinta Gonzalez, an organizer for a group called the Congress of Day Laborers. She says collectively, the workers in Kenner were owed over $100,000.
These workers spent 2 weeks of hard work, were expecting to get paid. Instead of getting paid, they had a raid. Immigration enforcement had coordinated with three law enforcement agencies. And so this just happened on August 29th, 2011, the anniversary of Katrina.
A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Orleans confirmed that ICE detained several individuals that day as part of an investigation of the company Louisiana Home Elevations. Its owner and an employee have been charged with 7 counts of harboring illegal aliens and money laundering. Despite the pressure from ICE, many New Orleans immigrants say they intend to hang on. On a recent workday night in a local Methodist church, about 40 immigrants are attending English classes. The pastor is Oscar Ramos. He calls for a show of hands as he asks a series of questions, like, how many people arrived after Katrina?
¿Cuánta gente vino después de Katrina? ¿Pudiera levantar su mano y decir?
Everyone raises their hand. How many have worked in rebuilding the city? A majority.
Probablemente la mayoría, ¿no?
Then he asks, how many people have been ripped off, not paid the money they earned? Virtually every hand shoots up.
Veces, muchas veces, la mayoría.
Later, a 37-year-old construction worker, Hugo Torres, says it happens because so many are illegal. But then he says he doesn't begrudge Americans who say he has no right to stay in New Orleans.
I mean, the word illegal, you know, I mean, I do understand that. I mean, what part of the word illegal we don't understand? Of course, illegal means illegal. I do understand, but with all this violence in Latin America, like Mexico and Central America, it's very difficult to live there. And I think the only way, you know, where we can see a future is it's the United States.
But what no one can yet say is how long New Orleans will see its future in these new immigrants. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
You can follow our series on Twitter at NPR Hard Times and on our website, npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, elections in the Ivory Coast were held this week, and so was the vote another step forward on the path to democracy or another disappointment for the strife-torn country? We'll try to find out later in the program. But first, we want to look closer at the employment picture in this country, especially at those who've been out of work for a long time. Actually, the most recent news about jobs has been good. The unemployment rate in the U.S. dropped to 8.6% in November, the first time it's dropped below 9% in quite some time. But that still means that more than 13 million people are still searching for jobs, and many more are still underemployed. Last night, President Obama acknowledged the frustration of many Americans on the CBS program 60 Minutes.
Well, look, we've gone through an incredibly difficult time in this country, and I would be surprised if the American people felt satisfied right now. They shouldn't feel satisfied. We've got a lot more work to do in order to get this country and the economy moving in a way that benefits everybody, as opposed to just a few.
The Kaiser Family Foundation and NPR recently conducted a survey about the impact of long-term unemployment. The report shows that there are nearly 5 million Americans who've been unemployed for a year or more. The research also explored why some segments of the population are harder hit by joblessness than others. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon, once again, NPR senior business editor Marilyn G. Wax. We also reached out to the National Employment Law Project, or NELP. That's a nonprofit that conducts research and advocacy on behalf of low-wage and unemployed workers. And they put us in touch with Vincent Brandon. He's currently an unemployed bus driver from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Also with us is Ellen Wright. She was a lab manager in Georgia, and she's been unemployed since she was downsized in 2005. They're joining us as part of NPR's week-long series, Still No Job, Over a Year Without Enough Work. Welcome to you both. Actually, welcome to all of you. Thank you all for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
Hello, Michelle.
Hi.
Well, Marilyn,
thank
you for coming. Marilyn, let me just start with you. I wanted to ask you, what are the key findings in this report?
Well, there's three things I wanted to tell you about that really jumped out at me. First of all, this group is really hurting. These are people who, generally speaking, they've been out of work a year or longer. Only 13% are getting any unemployment benefits. They're really pretty much on their own. And the thing is, before, when they did have jobs, the great majority of people made $30,000 a year or less. So they started out pretty underpaid, and now they have nothing. So they're relying on friends. They're cutting back on things like medical care. About half of them say they have trouble just keeping a roof over their head or food on the table. So this is a group in real distress. Number two, who are they? Well, disproportionately, they're African American. About 10% of the full-time workforce is African American, but 27% of the long-term unemployed are Black. So that really sort of jumps out. And the other thing is they tend to be older, over 55. Only about 13% of full-time workers are over 55, but they're 25% of the long-term unemployed. So that's pretty disproportionate. And then the final thing I wanted to talk about is that it's clear from what people say that they're willing to do almost anything to get employed again. They're willing to switch fields, retrain, take a night shift, work weekends. These are not people saying, I'm just going to sit here and hope something comes to me. They're actively trying to find jobs, and they're willing to make sacrifices to make it work.
Any job. Ellen, let me start with you. And first, let me just say I'm so sorry for what you're going through.
Oh, thank you.
And I do want to emphasize again that you were downsized. This was not an issue of your performance on the job. There was a takeover and a familiar story to many people. You're not African American. You are white, but you are part of that over 55 group. And you have made it clear, as I understand it, that you're willing to do just about anything to find a job. I just wanted to ask you, when did you realize that this was going to be a tough road to hoe in finding another job?
I knew it from the get-go. I knew that I was going to be a beginner in a new field, and I was older. People were going to look at me with my previous job experience and wonder why I wasn't going back into my old field. It was just going to be difficult from the very start.
Why did people think you should be going back into your old field? It was just kind of an assumption?
Yes, ma'am.
And are there any jobs in your field, in your area? Let me just ask the question then, since people are asking you that. Why aren't you going back into your
own field? Which field are you talking about?
The lab management.
The lab field?
Lab field.
No, not really. They have gone heavily into technology, and they are downsizing and going to the mega labs. The big Quest and LabCorp-type labs. So, no, those jobs are disappearing as well.
So you feel like your field is contracting?
My old field, yeah.
Your old field, yeah. Vincent, let's bring you into the conversation. Let me say, I'm sorry to you as well for what you're going through. It has to be difficult.
It is. Thank you, Michelle.
And I understand that you are African-American, so you're part of a group that has been particularly hard hit, although you have not been unemployed as long as Ellen. In fact, it's been less than a year. But I wanted to ask, you know, what steps have you been taking to find another job? I take it that you don't feel that the field you were in before is the one that you want to stay in.
That's correct. I decided to go back to school. I'm taking training in web design specifically to become more marketable to youth advocacy nonprofits. I worked in the field before, and I just wanted to return to a love that I had working in the community, working with young people.
How did you figure out web design was the way to go?
Well, it's something that young people are interested in, but a lot of, areas that I've lived in, those are skills that young people don't have and don't have access to learning. So I wanted to be in a position to be able to train young people to do that.
We're talking about the impact of long-term unemployment. The Kaiser Family Foundation and NPR recently authored a report exploring why some Americans are disproportionately affected by unemployment. With us are NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn G. Wax. Also with us are Vincent Brannon, that's who was talking just now, and Ellen Wright, who are both searching for work. Marilyn, you heard that both Vincent and Ellen are trying to train for new fields. How effective is that as a strategy? Is it proving effective?
Well, you really have no choice in many cases where if you're being downsized and your field is shrinking, you do need to retrain. But it can be very hard unless you combine that with a willingness or an ability to move as well. The one thing that did come out in this study is that only 44% of people who were long-term unemployed said they could relocate to another state. Well, you know,
why can't they move?
Pretty understandable in this housing market. Your home value may have plunged a great deal. It's very hard to sell a house. I mean, some people in some communities, they really don't have an option to sell their house because they'd take such a huge loss. And then if you move to another city, you've got all the problems of, you know, finding a new apartment. You have to put down a deposit, pay the utilities. It's very expensive to move. So people tend to be trapped in their current location. So if you retrain and you're in a smaller community where the jobs just aren't available, then you're really in a tough situation. So it's really hard. You have to put together the whole package of being able to move, retrain, and take – here's another tough thing is sometimes you need unpaid internships to get a foothold into the new industry.
Well, Vincent, what about you? Have you considered looking in places other than the Pittsburgh area for work, Pittsburgh being where you are now?
It's not an option for me right now. I have a 5-year-old daughter who is here in Pittsburgh, and I can't really, you know, leave out of this area and leave her here.
And still be the parent you want to be.
Absolutely.
Ellen, what about you?
No. We have a farm here. We have family in the area, elderly parents. We have too much money invested. We could never replace what we have here.
So you feel you'd be worse off if you left the area? Well, before I let each of you go, and thank you, and I understand that we've only just scratched the surface of what has to be a very difficult situation for both of you, and again, I want to wish you both the best. How are you keeping your spirits up?
For me, it's just innate optimism and my faith.
And Vincent, what about you?
Same, 100% faith. I mean, you know, I found that I've gotten much closer to my Lord and Savior during this time. So, I mean, it's turned out to be a blessing for me, you know.
I understand. Marilyn, final thought for you. Are there any, yeah, I understand that these issues are being hotly debated, you know, on Capitol Hill right now, as well as at the White House. But are there any anything being debated right now from a policy perspective that you think would specifically address the concerns that we've heard here today?
Well, the thing is that there needs to be a lot of emphasis on job retraining, and that's a local, state, and federal issue in terms of you've got to have community colleges helping people with retraining, and you have to be able to help people. There is an argument for whether or not to extend those unemployment benefits so that people can continue to try to have some help in moving, in getting themselves back into the workforce.
Well, what about the specific relocation issue that we talked about? In both cases, you have people who, for reasons of family, for reasons of housing, don't have the income, don't have the ability to move. Is there anything being discussed around that whole question of matching workers in one place to the jobs that might be available anywhere else? Is there any discussion of that?
Honestly, ultimately, some problems just resist solutions from government. These are personal decisions, and people who have children, who have aging parents, a lot of these things just come down to you need to be able to create jobs all over the country so that people don't have to just move to big cities, that you can find jobs everywhere. And that's a tough issue, really hard.
To be continued. Marilyn Geewax is NPR senior business editor. She joined us in our studios here in Washington, D.C. Vincent Brandon joined us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Ellen Wright joined us from Grantville, Georgia. They all spoke with us as part of NPR series Still No Job, Over a Year Without Enough Work. And to see the full results of the Kaiser Family Foundation and NPR report, please go to our website, npr.org. I thank you all so much, and my very best wishes to all of you.
Thanks, Michelle.
The payroll tax cut was originally designed to put more money in people's paychecks so they'll spend more and boost the economy. NPR's Jeff Brady talked with holiday shoppers outside Philadelphia to see if that's working.
In downtown Glenside, Pennsylvania, the shopping district is in transition. Near the high-end luggage store and a gift shop is a longtime pest control business with cockroaches and other bugs on display. Still, there are plenty of shoppers here with opinions.
My name's Kyle Congdon. I'm from Carbondale, Pennsylvania, and I go to Arcadia University.
So there's been an extra 2% in your paycheck over the last year. Did you notice it?
I honestly did not notice it, but I'm glad it's there.
The tax cut boosted the average family's take-home pay by about $1,000 last year. But during an afternoon of talking with shoppers, none were aware of this.
Well, by the way, we find the same thing in our research.
Joel Slimrod is an economics professor at the University of Michigan. He also researched what taxpayers did with the extra money. A few said they spent it, about half said they used it to pay off debts, and a third said they saved it.
Their assets are falling, their debt has increased, so they take advantage of higher disposable income to cut back on their debt or add a cushion to their savings.
Back with our shoppers near Philadelphia, it's not too difficult to find one of those savers. Matthew Damp stopped by a video game store.
Anything I have left over at the end of the month in a budget is saved. So if there was 10 or 20 extra dollars in there, it was probably saved rather than spent.
Even though Damp isn't complying with the theory behind the payroll tax cut to get people to spend more and boost the economy, he supports extending and maybe even expanding it.
More money sounds nice, whether it's saved or spent. I mean, for me, I'm probably going to save it, but it sounds like a lot of people would spend it, and that seems like it would be beneficial for the economy.
Just down the street in a gift shop called Sweet Magnolia, shopper Marlena Santoyo says expanding the tax cut now could help small businesses like this one.
I think especially, come to think of it, now at this season, Christmas or Hanukkah, that yes, some people would be inclined to do a bit of shopping.
That assumes the tax cut is expanded. But what if the reverse happens and shoppers learn the tax cut will end soon, and families will have less to spend next year? Here's Howard Gleckman of the Tax Policy Center in Washington.
I think if people believe that this money is going to be taken away from them, they're likely to be a little more cautious in their spending behavior over the holidays.
That prospect has business owners in this neighborhood hoping Democrats and Republicans will be able to reach agreement on at least extending the tax cut into next year. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
You're listening to NPR News.